We're starting at number 10 because I actually have a... The moderator will be leaving a little early, so don't be offended if I leave. You know, it's not that I think this panel is awful. I just have to catch a plane, and they warned me that apparently I didn't leave myself quite enough time. So we'll start with number 10, but then we'll be hearing a lot more. I'll be very quick on the 10th development. Then we'll hear from others, and we're going to save questions to the end. And just to remind you that there are microphones, which will be really helpful if you can go to those as well. Just to let you know, I'm Amy Campbell. I direct the Institute for Health Law and Policy at the University of Memphis School of Law, and this is the top 10 legal development session, so hopefully you're in the right place. You're stuck here now. No. And I'm going to be talking actually about guns, which is why not come to Texas and talk about gun control. But a lot of the flurry of activity that's happening around the reality of gun violence, but a lot of the legislation and legal push that's connecting it to mental illness. So why guns? Just briefly, why I think it's important, you know, this might not be the most obvious sort of emerging, late-breaking legal development, but I think it's really important, especially in the field of bioethics, that we think about things that really do affect our communities every day. And as you can see, the number of firearm deaths really does dwarf a lot of other things that we might give more attention to around, like maybe, you know, illegal drug overdose or AIDS, or as the president had urged people to look at, some of the terrorist activities. Firearm deaths are we have over 33,000 a year of firearm deaths. So that's something that we have to think about. So our legislative focus, just what's been happening, there is this desire, as you know, from sort of the Second Amendment derived to balance kind of gun rights and the idea of safety. But in reaction, there's been a lot of flurry of activity to a lot of the mass killings and primarily the sort of public, non, you know, sort of familial kind of incidents that happen and that really have put a head on where we want to go with gun control. And sort of the conflating this idea of safety with mental illness. You hear people say a lot, guns don't kill people, people kill people, and now it's mentally ill people kill people. And so late breaking just this month, the Senate Democrats have a package, and I've just highlighted sort of where things are going, where there is sort of common agreement. They want to look at sort of the typical kind of gun controls, but there's this desire to expand background checks, and that will include to be more rigorous around people that have history of commitment for mental illness or things of that nature. Representative McSally has, I think this is really telling, the Mental Health and Safe Communities Act. So you hear a lot about how we need to do more by the mental health system, but a lot of that is tied to this idea that it's people with mental illness that are causing all of our sort of violence. This is sad for me to say, as someone who's would be generally positively inclined towards candidate Hillary Clinton. If you go to her website, her gun control package has the statement that we want to keep the guns out of the hands of domestic abusers, other criminals, and the severely mentally ill. So it's kind of lumping people with mental illness with those who commit domestic violence and those who are criminals. And so this really is a policy issue. It's sort of a legislative focus, and you may wonder why for bioethics. And it really is kind of a moral issue that a lot of sort of ethical concerns about, is evidence really informing that this sort of legislative push that we see happening in October? Are we thinking about sort of where the gun violence actually is happening and the equity implications of that? And when we're calling for a better mental health system, are we doing that from a therapeutic, what should be a therapeutic orientation, rather than this idea around safety? And so just briefly, just to let you know the evidence, you can see here that there is in the red, if you look there, those are the deaths. There are, as I mentioned before, over 33,000 firearm casualties a year, which is, you know, a problem. But where is this happening? We hear about these mass killings, and there are maybe, you know, a couple people would die in each of those. But on average, 90 people in the U.S. die a day from gun violence, but we don't hear about a lot of that. And where it's happening with homicides especially is with our young black men. So if you look at it, if you're between the ages of 20 and 29 and you're African-American male, you're 20 times more likely to die through a gun than you are if you are not an African-American male. And a lot of this is tied to poverty. And so we are looking at sort of gun control, and we're really focusing on mental illness when a lot of the gun violence we're seeing in terms of homicide certainly relates to poverty. Yet what we're doing is we're kind of conflating gun control with a mental illness in our lawmaking and the recent sort of push. And yet if you look at the evidence, even if you controlled for all mental illness, you'd only get 4%. You'd still be left with 96% of the gun violence. And so when we think about legislation, and I think when we think of sort of as bioethicists around these kind of issues, we should be really making sure that the psychiatry and the mental health professions are promoting gun control as a means as sort of keeping people from self-inflicted harm. Because a lot of the violence that we see with people with mental illness is directed towards themselves and not others. And you can see here sort of the suicide. Two-thirds of the homicides each year, firearm deaths each year are due to suicide. And so, and if you see here that sort of the brightest blue, that's your firearm death. So if people have access to a gun, they're a lot more likely to sort of be completers, if you will, with a suicide. Particularly here we see it with white men. And so this is just a sort of the imagery that we see, and it's really sort of what's taken hold in the legislative push that we have right now. And I think we have to be very careful and have our voices that contribute to this that say, what does the evidence actually say? Is quote-unquote madness the real push behind our homicide numbers and our sort of suicide numbers, and how do we go with that? And so I'll just be on my soapbox for a moment. It's not on there, but I just, you know, what I was amazed with is that you'll see that there is a lot of, you know, push to license what's dangerous and all, and I just did a search, and in Tennessee, where I'm from, in Memphis, there are a lot more restrictions on licensing and permitting for my dog than there are for guns. And so I had a picture, it didn't show up, but of my dog, and I will just tell you that my dog is a small little terrier and is a lot less threatening, I would guess, than a handgun. Yet that's kind of where our legislative focus is going right now. All right, with that, we'll go to Dr. Lombardo. Thank you for letting me start at the end.
Okay, I'm Paul Lombardo. I'm at the Georgia State College of Law in Atlanta. And I'm going to talk about roughly three things. The first batch of things is all related to artificial reproductive technologies, sexuality and genetics, I guess, and then a bit about vulnerable populations and mental illness. These two ladies are Sheena and Tiara Yates, and they have been in a civil union since 2011. They were married after the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage last year, and the timing of those events is critical to this account. They had a son who was conceived at home by artificial insemination, or if you'd rather, alternative insemination, in June of 2013 after being counseled by a physician. They went to their doctor and asked how this would work, gave them some information. They went ahead and did it themselves. This is a critical part of the account. He did not actively participate in the insemination. The couple had already had one child who was conceived in the same way, but from a different donor. In both cases, they signed contracts with the men who were involved, saying that the men waived any parental rights. About 6 months after the second child was born, the sperm donor made a legal claim, made a demand for rights of visitation. And then about 6 months after that, the other one did too. And so we had a situation in which two different courts were considering the futures of two different children who had been conceived the same way but at different times for legal purposes, because at one point their mothers were married and at the second point they were not. The women learned, unfortunately, to their chagrin, that state law in New Jersey was similar to state law elsewhere, which contained a presumption for donors, for sperm donors, that they had no obligations for children who were born as long as a physician was actively involved in the insemination process. That wasn't the case for either of these. And so when they went to trial, the couple found that the first claimant who wanted to have visitation rights won, That was the child that was born while they were in civil union but not married. The second trial occurred, and the result was that the same result. That is, the court awarded visitation to the second man, but also imposed an obligation of child support, something like $365 a month. They decided to appeal that one. And so this case is on appeal now, and it focuses on whether or not the marriage, which in fact occurred before their second child was born, gives them the benefit, which is common in the law, of a presumption that children born to married couples are usually not subject to parental claims by people outside of the marriage. It also looks at whether that presumption would apply in replacing the other presumption that usually applies, that is, that when the statute says you have to be that a physician has to be the active member in artificial insemination cases, whether or not the presumption of being a parent would trump what happened to them in both courts. That is to say that they were not considered, that the insemination was not considered covered by the statute because they didn't have a doctor involved. So this is one of several cases in recent years that goes beyond the recognition of marriage by same-sex couples, and in fact asks whether the marriage will be treated in things like rights to custody, parenting, adoption, and the like, the same way that traditional heterosexual marriages have been treated. The second case is a case that is currently pending in federal court, and it has to do with the American Society of Reproductive Medicine and some other groups which have adopted guidelines on how much to pay egg donors. So the first case was sperm donors. This case is egg donors. In 2011, Lindsay Kamahaki sued the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. A number of fertility clinics, egg agencies, and others that had agreed to abide by the ASRM guidelines for donor compensation. The major contention in the lawsuit was that the federal antitrust law, the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act, which prohibit contracts, conspiracies, and combinations in restraint of trade, whether that should be applied to the actions of the ASRM in adopting a semi-uniform guidelines for donor compensation. The basis of the suit is that those guidelines encourage quote, reasonable compensation for gamete donors, and also say that payments to women providing oocytes should be fair and not so substantial that they become undue inducements that will lead donors to discount risks. In other words, pay enough, but not too much. This is the same dilemma that was faced by, that is always faced by IRBs who attempt to do the Goldilocks maneuver of making sure that people who participate in research are compensated reasonably, but not so much that they might feel unduly influenced or coerced to participate in research. The ASRM guidelines suggest that less than $5,000 per egg donation is probably okay, but more than $10,000 may be inappropriate, and these numbers are actually now more than about 10 years old. So this lawsuit has cleared the first few hurdles. It's a class action now. It's been certified. And it will allow most women who have entered the egg-selling marketplace to become plaintiffs. There is a trial anticipated on the merits within a year. This case involves IVF, in vitro fertilization. And this is Mrs. Emily Herks, who is an English teacher at St. Vincent de Paul Catholic School in Fort Wayne, Indiana. After she was unable to become pregnant, she decided to initiate efforts to conceive via in vitro fertilization, and when the administrators at her school and in the diocese in which she worked heard about this, she eventually was released from her job. She subsequently filed a discrimination lawsuit against the school and the Diocese of Fort Wayne, South Bend. The church took a couple of interesting maneuvers early on, first claiming that it was not under the jurisdiction of the federal court and therefore would not show up. The judge didn't buy that. The Court of Appeals did not either. So when they were back in court, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the religious freedom exemptions in the law did not give the church immunity from the case more generally. They then had to consider whether or not the discrimination lawsuit was contained an appropriate claim in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Ms. Herks had said that she was infertile, and that was a disability, and therefore she was fired for her disability. The court dismissed that claim, but went on to say that she could bring a claim under under the theory of sex discrimination. She said no man had ever been fired for accessing IVF, and she was a woman, and she had been singled out because of that. And so her case went on to trial. In December of 2014, a jury awarded her $1.75 million plus some medical expenses and lost wages. Total was about $1.9 million. That award was reduced to something around $500,000. That case is now on appeal in the federal courts. And once again, the Seventh Circuit's going to have to decide whether the reach of anti-discrimination law in terms of IVF will be balanced against the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which has prerogatives for religious institutions, which have not yet been applied to this particular fact pattern. In another case that finally went to trial last year, we had a couple, Donna and Henry Rahans. They're shown here at their wedding in 2007. Mr. Rahans was a farmer and a former legislator in Iowa. His wife Donna and he were married in 2007. They both had been married before. After about 2 years, she was diagnosed with progressive dementia. And in 2014, she was moved by her adult daughters to a nearby nursing facility that specialized in Alzheimer's care. And she died there last August. After about a month after her death, her daughters complained to local prosecutors that their stepfather had sexual relations with his wife in the nursing home after having been counseled that she was unable to give legally binding consent to such involvement. And the charges of sexual assault were filed. The case went to trial. There was a lot of testimony about what were alleged to be instances of involvement with DNA testing the sheets and such as that. Eventually, Mr. Rahans was acquitted. There was no evidence introduced at the trial that his wife Donna had ever protested or refused to be affectionate with her husband. In fact, she had behaved the way she always did. So this is thought to be one of the first cases of prosecution for sexual assault involving family members when one party is suffering from dementia or other cognitive deficits. It raises a long-standing and much-debated issue of whether people with mental disabilities are capable of giving consent to sexual relations and whether they should be entitled to having a full sex life without regard to their mental state. The aging population, I'm talking about some of us, and increasing numbers of seniors diagnosed with cognitive difficulties, not to speak of the complexities of today's modern families with blends of all kinds, makes this an area of potential controversy. And I think we have suggested that perhaps this will give rise to a new field where people have lawyers write sexual powers of attorney. In the next case, we have a genetic discrimination claim. And that claim involves some men in an employment context. In one more instance of the usual bioethics epithet that you can't make this stuff up, we have a case described by a presiding federal judge as the mystery of the devious defecator. In which a company did DNA testing in an attempt to identify employees who had repeatedly fouled the workplace, and the company was then found liable for violating the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. And the press picked this up and said, frustrated supervisors at a warehouse outside Atlanta were trying to figure out who was leaving piles of feces around the facility. They pulled aside two laborers whom they suspected. The men, fearing for their jobs, agreed to have DNA tests done and to see whether they were a match. And Jack Lowe, one of the men in the picture there, a forklift operator, said the word spread quickly and they became objects of humiliation in the workplace. The men were eventually cleared. It turns out there was no match. They kept their jobs, but they eventually sued the company. And in May, Judge Jamie Totenberg of the federal court there ruled in favor of the laborers. The case turned on the definition of a genetic test. The company had argued that the tests were merely for identification purposes and they didn't probe any diagnostic issues. The judge said that didn't matter. The definition of genetic test in the lawsuit was broad enough to cover what they did. And the And the under JENA, no employee may request, require, or purchase genetic information. In this case, the actual perpetrators have not been identified and are still at large. But when the case went to trial, the decision of the jury was that they should be awarded $2.25 million. That award also was later reduced. There's a statutory cap, and so each man received $300,000. But nevertheless, the case stands for a very, very powerful message to companies who might consider doing genetic tests for any reason. And I should say, by way of full disclosure, that I was a witness in that case on the issue of the legislative history of the act. I have to say that we knew from the beginning that this case was going to be one for the books, but it was unclear which part of the book it would end up in. The next case is a case out of Nashville, Tennessee. Tennessee passed a law in 2014 criminalizing drug abuse by pregnant women. In 2015, this young lady, Jasmine Randers, was in transit through Nashville. She had her situation was that she'd been under court supervision for mental illness when she left her home in Minnesota. She ended up in West Memphis, Arkansas, and then fled to a homeless shelter in Nashville. She reported awakening in a motel where she'd slept in a bed with her baby who had just been born, and only to find when she awakened that the child was unresponsive. She called a taxi. They went to the hospital, and the baby was dead. She was arrested for child neglect. When the prosecutor on the case took the case, the assistant district attorney, he insisted that she undergo sterilization as a deal for not being prosecuted. The legal aid attorney complained to the district attorney, the supervisor, and the junior attorney was taken off the case. It turned out this was a habit that he had of proposing that anyone who was involved in cases like this should be sterilized. He eventually lost his job, and the prosecutor and the defense attorney worked out a plea deal where this woman actually was committed to an institution where she could get some care. This is a case that got a lot of negative press, and the prosecutor decided that they would make it a matter of policy that these kinds of plea deals not be offered. I guess this is my last case, and that is to report that the Johns Hopkins University has been sued for $1 billion in a lawsuit that derived from the infamous now Guatemala Public Health Service litigation. The government had already been sued. That case had been dismissed in April of this year. The second suit was filed against Hopkins in a Maryland court, and a lawyer representing approximately 60 individuals who alleged that they had been involved in the studies or that they were relatives of people who had been involved, another 800 people in that category, and believed that their family members had been infected with STDs or had been research participants in other ways, had been harmed by these studies. The theory is that many Hopkins scientists and doctors were critical in the operation of the government research effort, and the lawsuit also names the Rockefeller University and some drug companies as defendants because, according to its terms, they had designed, supported, encouraged, and financed the penicillin research that went on in Guatemala. No real activity in that suit since it's been filed. So that's my top list, and I'll turn it over at this point to Art. Art, Dad, Art, whichever.
Okay, Art it is. You can tell we prepared pretty well as far as our order go. Well, good morning. I'm Art Dursey from the Medical College of Wisconsin, the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities, and I'm going to talk about three developments, one about advanced care planning, one about physician-assisted suicide, and finally, progress on medical marijuana. There's more end-of-life to come in our talk today. But I'd like to start with advanced care planning, advanced directives, and POLST. So as some of you know, there was an important report that came out a year ago that was looking at dying in America. And essentially, the summary of that report is we still don't do end of life well. We need palliative care, better communication, better education, and a lot of other things. But interestingly, we don't need better laws. We actually have many mechanisms that are quite adequate for end of life care, including advanced directives, pre-hospital DNRs, POLST, and the authors of the report noted that futility and physician-assisted suicide are important issues. So this is Night of the Living Will. And advanced directives, as you may remember, originally had a bad rap that completion really didn't change anything in people's care, but that was then and this is now. Subsequently, patients who'd prepared advanced directives received care that's strongly associated with their preferences. The big news on this front is that the so-called death panels that prevented advanced care planning, counseling, actually have come to fruition. You'll remember that CMS tried to issue a rule that would have allowed this. It was effective January 1st and rescinded 4 days later in 2011, although physicians were not restricted from discussing end-of-life care. In the interim, insurers and state Medicaid organizations did reimburse for this, but finally, in 2016, beginning January 1st, 2016, there will be two CPT codes for the physicians in the audience. You know how important this is as far as reimbursement for these discussions, one for the first 30 minutes and then subsequent. Again, this didn't prevent physicians and others from talking about end-of-life care, but it now gives organizations financial incentives to be able to have that completion done. The other news is that resuscitation success rates are still incredibly low. So this is a National Academy of Sciences a headline that says when someone has a cardiopulmonary arrest in the community, only 6 out of 100 resuscitation attempts will be successful. And it was a plea, essentially, for more research to be able to be done in this area to improve that. However, it turns out that funding agencies in the federal government are starting to look at the only minor incremental success of various strategies to be able to address this, and is trying to put more money in things that would be of more success in the long run. And of course, the issue about resuscitation is you can always do more. There's a study that shows that if you want to catch 99.1% of all survivors, you should be doing it for 35 minutes. Now, you may ask, well, what about the 9 out of 1,000 who survive that went longer than 35 minutes? What's our endpoint in resuscitation? So, of course, one of the approaches with respect to this is in the advanced care planning discussions to think about whether or not you want resuscitation and talking with patients and families about this issue and then documenting it. And, of course, if people go by television as an indicator, the survival rate is so much better on television than it is in real life. And there was a study that repeated, a classic study, that showed that it's only slightly less unrealistic than two decades ago. Most of the people on television have successful resuscitations, because otherwise it would be a pretty boring plot line to have most of them die. So this is actually, of course, a real issue. In Minnesota, paramedics responded to a long-term care facility. Son pressed an emergency call button when the mother was vomiting in her sleep. Of course, people called 911. The paramedics responded. There was no DNR pulsed. And they stopped resuscitation at the request of the husband, who held the power of attorney for health care, which was activated. But there was no policy for withholding CPR without DNR or a pulse document. So it was actually investigated by the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, who determined that there were no criminal laws that were violated, but a complaint was filed nonetheless, and it's being investigated. And I think the issue is this kind of so-called in-the-moment decision-making, like, well, let's kind of make a decision without advanced care planning or thinking about this ahead of time, is actually something that paramedics with a husband who holds a power of attorney for health care can't do. Some people feel very strongly, of course, about making sure that their wishes are known. And the PULSE paradigm is something that many of you are familiar with. The news on this is that, and this is just an example of such a document, but states have come on board in great numbers. 5 states in the past 3 years, but in just this single past year. So this is the map as of 2014, a year ago, and you see it getting darker. And in fact, 2 more states are on board. So now there are actually only 5 states without a program. Sorry for the typo on the bottom. But those 5 states are those in white. So at least that's one approach to this. And the PULSE paradigm is one that, like advanced care planning and advanced directive, shows that most of the people who have these documents, 94% of their DNR orders are honored, 84% of their resuscitate orders are honored, and you get resuscitated more likely with a PULSE document than if you don't have one automatically. So the next big development, and it's a big development because a lot of things have been happening in this area, is physician-assisted suicide. You'll remember in the United States there is no constitutional right to this. States are free to develop their own laws, and by 2013 we had Oregon, Washington, Montana, and Vermont as states that had enacted this. Interestingly, public opinion still is very favorable. 68% favor this. Most of the increased support came from 18 to 34-year-olds. The fact that the word suicide is used doesn't seem to temper issues about support. And it increased among all major political affiliations. And 28% oppose it. This is just a graph showing the variation, but in general, the support for this. This says, no can do, Mrs. DiPietro, I'd be breaking my whatchamacallit oath. In fact, physicians are now, the majority of physicians are now supportive, and this is actually news. Since only 5 years ago, only 46% were in support of physician-assisted suicide. And again, I'm using the term physician-assisted suicide, and my apologies if your preferred terms are others. So this says, yes, Oregon's lovely, but we're just here for the suicide. And my apologies if you've seen these before. These are statistics, and we are not going to go into them, but just to say that Oregon has a 17-year experience with this, in which people have reasons of loss of autonomy, loss of activities enjoyed, and loss of their dignity. But in general, pain, finances, and out-of-state people coming to the state for this are really not an issue. Same is true for Washington with their 6-year experience. Montana had something that was very interesting. They, of course, legalized physician-assisted suicide in a Supreme Court decision in 2009, and there was legislation this year to essentially undo that, which passed in the House, in the Montana House, but did not leave the Senate Judiciary Committee. So there is a movement in Montana to essentially undo the court decision. Vermont, with the Patient Choice and Control at End of Life Act, passed their law in 2013, they modeled it on the Oregon law, although there wasn't as much of a regimen of records accumulation. But the interesting thing of their law was that all the provisions were set to expire in 2016, and Vermont essentially said, what part of yes don't you understand? They had a permanent version of the assisted bill suicide law signed, and according to a colleague, there have been 11 prescriptions issued, and perhaps that number, since the issue of tracking those is one that Vermont is still facing. New Mexico was a state that had also temporarily legalized this because of a trial court decision in 2014, but the appellate court said no, New Mexico really does not support aid in dying. It prohibits it, and it is not unconstitutional to have that statute. They certainly are sending it back to the trial court to remand it to see whether or not it passes a rational basis standard of review as applied to aid in dying, which it probably will. New York has a litigation, including plaintiffs that include Tim Quill, that make two arguments. The state's assisted suicide law doesn't apply to physicians, and if it does, it violates the New York Constitution. That's pending right now, a motion to dismiss. A trial court case in Kentucky was unsuccessful, arguing something similar. Maine also had a referendum in 2000 that failed. House and Senate voted this year as far as physician-assisted suicide. House approved. The Senate rejected very narrowly. California is the big news. In 1992, an aid in dying referendum was defeated, and there have been bills between then and now. The California Medical Association changed from opposition to a neutral stance. Brittany Maynard, who was alive last year when we last met here, accomplished her planned death in 2014 and I think significantly changed the conversation. A couple of cases in California, one in the San Diego Superior Court that was dismissed, the judge saying that this was the statute that restricts this is constitutional and basically it's for the legislature to fix. And another case in San Francisco, essentially using the same tech, pretty much became moot after the End of Life Options Act that was passed by the Senate and Assembly was signed by the governor. The signing statement by the governor of California said, in the end, I was left to reflect on what I want in the face of my own death, and it would be a comfort to be able to consider the options afforded by this bill, and I wouldn't deny that right to others. The legislation is somewhat or very similar to Oregon with a few changes. It's got the usual restrictions, annual report, immunities. This is, I also do suicides. The Minnesota Final Exit Network had a case in which they were held liable for assisting a patient in her suicide. First time that the organization was fined for its activities. It has avoided felony convictions previously. Important also in Canada is the Carter versus Canada case that some of you have been following. That case essentially is an assisted suicide constitutional case that has wended its way through the courts. And I'm going to skip the past history, but to tell you that when it finally hit the Supreme Court of Canada, the unanimous 9-0 decision was that the statutory ban violated the Canadian Charter, specifically Section 7, the right to life, liberty, and the security of the person. And it is restricted to a competent adult who has a grievous and irremediable medical condition. However, it's not necessarily limited to terminal conditions of individual. It gives the federal and provincial governments 1 year to have a legislative and regulatory framework to match this. There also, of course, was a bill last year that passed in the Quebec National Assembly that allowed more interventive action at the end of life. And I actually can't tell you what the effect of the Canadian Supreme Court on that will be. It's possible that Quebec's law will still stay as it is. Scotland had an assisted suicide bill that they defeated. New Zealand had an important case in which an advocate for assisted suicide happened to die on the day that the decision was disclosed, that New Zealand's Bill of Rights does not support assisted suicide. So the last piece is marijuana. This says, no, I won't prescribe medical marijuana for you because the people who make it won't fly me to the Caribbean for conferences. So this doctor obviously does have a conflict of interest. Medical marijuana has moved on. Plenty of states in 2014. The map shows in the light color green the ones that also allow it for recreational use. 23 states and the District of Columbia, a number of measures, including Alaska, Oregon, were successful. Florida was not. It was decriminalized in Delaware, cannabis oil permitted for patients in Georgia, and plenty of issues with conflicts with federal law. And that's my piece, the End of Your Life Book Club. I kind of mentioned at the talk my recommendations for your reading. Of course, I think you should read this book, Being Mortal. Two others are on my reading list, The Shift by Teresa Brown, and also Stone by David Kasserat. I'm hoping to be, unfortunately, I've not yet read these, and I'm a little bit behind in my reading. I'm hoping to be able to use the fact that I'm behind in my reading at a very critical time. This is, but I haven't caught up on my back issues of The New Yorker. Thank you.
All right. Buckle your seatbelts. I'm Thaddeus Pope. I'm at the Hamline University School of Law. I'm going to talk about three topics: futility, brain death, and patient decision aids. Futility. So as you know, this is a big issue. It comprises a significant percentage of hospital ethics consults. The latest study to be published from Loyola Chicago, 16% of their consults. There was a study earlier this year published in Critical Care Medicine. They surveyed 700 critical care clinicians, and they reported, 80% reported, that non-beneficial treatment is a big problem, and they see it all the time. They also asked those clinicians not just about the problem, but about the solution. And a majority identified a specific solution they thought was good, which is that we should create and implement committees who could issue binding decisions in these cases. Well, in fact, that's the example of that, or the best example of that, is right here in Texas. And so where we have the Texas Advanced Directives Act. And basically, that statute says that the physician may stop life-sustaining treatment without consent for any reason if the hospital review committee agrees. And that law was passed in 1999, and the Texas legislature meets every other year. And so for six sessions in a row, 25 to 30 bills were introduced to either repeal or amend the Texas Advanced Directives Act. They all failed, and the act continued just as it was in 1999, until this year when the governor signed a bill, HB 3074. And basically what HB 3074 did is it amended the Texas Advanced Directives Act to exclude from its scope artificially administered nutrition and hydration. So the physician or the hospital may unilaterally refuse a whole range of life-sustaining treatments without the surrogate's consent if they follow the process, but not artificially administered nutrition and hydration. So in a nutshell, the statute and the whole scheme continues pretty much just as it was. It's just narrowed in this one specific way. So moving from Texas to Indiana, in Indiana, there is a case involving this woman, Geraldine Siner. Ms. Siner was 86 years old with advanced dementia, and the hospital in Indianapolis, where she was a patient, wrote a DNR order without her family's consent, and in fact over and despite the family's vehement objections. The family sued for medical malpractice. In Indiana, you have to go to a pre-suit review committee. They did that. The committee determined that the hospital had breached the standard of care, so they proceeded to file the lawsuit in court. But the trial court granted summary judgment to the hospital and clinicians because determining that the family could not prove causation, because as Art already mentioned, it's very difficult to establish that CPR would have worked anyway, so the fact that we didn't provide it, you can't show is causally related to any injuries. That, although, was reversed by the Indiana Court of Appeals, which says there is enough evidence on causation, and therefore the family can proceed to trial. And then just to move from Indiana to Connecticut, where there's a case where Yale removed a ventilator of a patient, Helen Marcella, without the consent of her family and over her family's objections. And what's, and this is going up on appeal now, it's being briefed right now, and the issue is whether or not they can state a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress. I suspect that they probably will be allowed to proceed on that theory. Every successful case in which a hospital has been sued for unilaterally withholding, withdrawing life-sustaining treatment has succeeded on the basis of this legal theory, not on the basis of malpractice, not on the basis of battery or informed consent, but on the basis of intentional infliction of emotional distress. You disconnected our loved one without our consent, sometimes without even our knowledge. That was likely to cause us emotional distress. Takeaway on this first unit, I think a few years ago people really thought that there was going to be a trend toward more Texas-type laws, a trend toward empowering clinicians to stand up to surrogates and withhold life support without consent. In other words, people thought there might be a trend toward green lights, green light for the clinician to proceed as she thought appropriate. In fact, it looks like the trend is perhaps toward more red lights, both in the legislative realm and in the courts. And the second point on the futility is that we have this Indiana appellate opinion, and now the Yale case is going to the appellate court. In the United States, we hardly have any appellate guidance. So just compare that to the UK, where they have dozens and dozens, nearly 50 published appellate opinions on futility cases, or Ontario, where they have dozens. We're a much bigger country, very little guidance. And so I think at least it's good that we're getting some clarity as to what, in fact, are the rights of patients and what, in fact, are the obligations of clinicians in these cases. Topic number two, brain death. And I have two cases here, right? So you may recall the case of Jahi McMath, right? Now she was, oh, by the way, it's her birthday today. She's 15. You may recall that in December 2013, there was a treatment conflict in San Francisco about whether or not she is or is not dead. That was resolved, and a death certificate was issued by Alameda County. And subsequently, she was then transferred, sustained on organ support, from San Francisco to New Jersey, where she still is. This year, the family filed a medical malpractice action against the Children's Hospital and the clinicians who caused her to be brain dead. And in that lawsuit, they sought future medical expenses as a significant component of the damages in that case, probably worth around $5 million. The thing, of course, is, as you can suspect, that dead people don't have future medical expenses. So it was pretty clear what they were seeking to do in the medical malpractice lawsuit was to relitigate her status as alive or dead. The defendants, the hospital and the individual clinicians, said, no, you don't get to do that because the state of California has already determined her dead, right? And it's the principle of collateral estoppel, which is you get one bite at the apple. We're not going to relitigate that. That's been adjudicated. We're done. This week, the Alameda County Superior Court said, no, let's give them a chance. Let's see if they can prove. They're going to get the opportunity to prove that she's alive. And it's interesting, just to point out exactly what's going on here, nobody disputes, not even the family, that she met the criteria for brain death in December 2013. It's not that the diagnosis was wrong at that time, it's that she met the criteria for brain death in December 2013, but she doesn't meet them now, right? That's never happened, right? It's kind of it's a permanent diagnosis, or it has been up till now. Family just posted on Facebook, it's her birthday today, like I said. As you can see, she's still alive, just as beautiful as ever. That complaint, or the amended complaint, is due November 9th. So we'll see how exactly they're going to prove that somebody who was dead is no longer dead and is now alive. Second case to move from California to Nevada is now pending before the Supreme Court of Nevada. Also involves a woman just a few years younger, a few years older than Jahai, Aiden Hailu. And here the argument's a little bit different, because here they're not saying that she no longer meets that, you know, like Jahai, where she once met but no longer meets the American Academy of Neurology criteria for brain death, but that those are the wrong criteria. Okay, that she may be dead on those criteria, but those aren't the right ones to be using. And in fact, there's something to that, because there is incredible variability in exactly how death is determined on the basis of neurological criteria across the country and across the world. And in fact, as you know, the criteria themselves are under some attack. Oral argument in that case is November 3rd. Takeaway on the brain death cases. This, what's long been an academic debate about brain death the last 5-10 years, you know, is now becoming more of a policy debate, because people are really bringing these arguments before appellate courts. And the second takeaway is that these cases have incredibly high profile, and it's causing more distrust among families, and there's a lot more, and they run to court and they get injunctions, like in this Lisa Avila case. In other words, injunctions ordering the hospital to continue physiological support. Ultimately, they get a third-party opinion, and the support is discontinued, but these injunctions can last 30, 40 days, and there's a lot more of them being granted across the country. Third topic is patient decision aids. And what I mean by this is, you know, videos, decision grids, interactive websites, right, that help convey information about the treatment choices that the patient is facing. Significant evidence shows that patient decision aids are highly effective, way more effective in making sure that patients understand the choices that they're facing than just having a face-to-face oral conversation with the physician. And in fact, there's been a whole bunch of studies on this, and there's even now been two Cochrane-level meta-reviews of those studies proving significant material improvement in patient understanding by the use of patient decision aids. But there's hardly any clinical usage of decision aids in medical practice in the United States. So, really, really good tool, not being used. So, people have been thinking, well, how can we use the law to incent greater use of patient decision aids? Well, this was built into the Affordable Care Act, now 5 years old. Unfortunately, even though CMS was directed to work on this, they have not. So we turn to the state of Washington. And what the state of Washington is doing now is certifying decision aids. So there's a lot of them being developed by HRQ, by for-profit companies, by non-profit companies. So not all of them are equally good. So we need to certify which ones are worth using. So they've already drafted criteria for certification, and they're now proceeding to actually certify the first set of decision aids. They're starting with obstetric now. Next year they're going to do joint replacements, and then they're going to do end-of-life decision aids. Why does that matter? What's the significance of certification of the decision aids? Well, first, under Washington state law already since 2007, if a physician uses a certified decision aid, then they have safe harbor legal immunity. It creates a presumption that they've satisfied their informed consent obligations. Secondly, the state of Washington is going to require, say Washington itself has 2 million public employees, right? As the single biggest purchaser of healthcare in the state of Washington, they're going to require that providers of healthcare to their employees use decision aids. Okay, now that's just the state of Washington, but here's the takeaway on this level. CMS is looking to Washington as a test, not officially, but an unofficial test pilot on this, okay? And so if this works, CMS is then going to finally do what they were sort of ordered to do in the Affordable Care Act 5 years ago. And basically, I think the significance is this, which is we're going to get to a point where if you're billing for a certain intervention, if you haven't used a decision aid with the patient for that intervention, then you're not going to get paid for that. So I'll stop there. Thanks. All right, so we have two, I think we have a few minutes, and there's two microphones in the aisles. Go ahead.
That was great. Thank you. I'm wondering I don't know the literature on the effectiveness of patient decision aids, but I can imagine there being problems in that they can come to replace doctor-patient communications. In other words, I can imagine a doctor saying, oh, just do this thing on your smartphone, and then we're going to operate on you. I mean, do you see any problems with that, or are there issues with that? And the other question is for the Guatemala case, the victim suing Hopkins. I'm wondering, is there any statute of limitations on something like that?
Are you doing the Guatemala?
Yeah, you go ahead and do it.
Okay, so on the decision aid, so everybody who's working on this, nobody has ever advocated that decision aids supplant the physician-patient interaction. It's that they supplement the physician-patient interaction. So ideally what would happen is they would be given a link, like go home, launch this and do it. And then you would come back and you would say, well, do you have any questions about it? Or better yet, the good software will track, right? It'll track, oh, it looks like you lingered on this particular page, which concerns this particular side effect. It's a physician will know that they spent, 12 minutes on that and only 4 minutes on the other pages. Let's talk about that. So it actually could improve and focus the physician-patient live discussion, so it would not replace it. Nobody's even suggested that might happen.
On the Guatemala case, that the allegations have been applied to what the plaintiffs say are a few live victims of the actual syphilis studies, but also a great many people whose involvement in the studies was that they gave blood for serology tests. This decision, if there is one, if the case persists, and that's a big if, would be under Maryland law, and then the question would be whether the ongoing harms were within the statute of limitations, and so that's going to be a factual question for the case if it continues.
Thaddeus, thank you for the update. Really appreciated your talk. As a critic of the Texas model, I was glad to hear your summary that most states are not following kind of that model on the futility issue. What are states doing as far as policy goes with conflict resolutions around care that might be futile? Are they adopting better definitions of futility? What do you see states as doing in the other direction?
So the two thing, if you look at like the last 3-4 years of statutes, a lot of states have passed disclosure laws. So if you have a futility policy, then you have to disclose that to the family. So Michigan, several other states have passed mandatory disclosure laws. And other states have passed, like in Oklahoma, not what I think they call the Non-Discrimination in Treatment Act, which is exactly the opposite of Texas. So where Texas kind of tells the clinician this is how you can proceed to override the surrogate, these laws basically say you can't ever override the surrogate. So that's why I say I think we're moving toward more red light to the physician. And so I think those are the two categories. They're basically saying if the surrogate wants it, you've got to give it. And then there's the disclosure statutes.
Has there been any success in definitions of what is meant in different states by medical futility?
No. That's like a 30-year-old. We can't define it, right? And so that's... No, I don't think anybody's defined it.
Okay, thanks.
So in other words, the legislatures aren't going to be able to do any better than the academics on that.
Hi, thank you. It's always my favorite session. About the cases where treatment was withdrawn against both patient and family wishes and against without a DNR, has there been any action taken just for the fact of doing that, regardless of the consequences of withholding or withdrawing the treatment? Just that oughtn't be done at all. Because I know you were talked about, whether the resuscitation would have worked, wouldn't have worked, but just about the mere fact of doing that without the permission and the non-DNR.
I'm not sure. I want to make sure I understand what you're asking.
Well, it seems that would possibly go against some sort of either professional code or regulations, with whether or not the action resulted in the physical harm of the patient.
To not resuscitate somebody who wanted to be resuscitated?
Yeah, or to withdraw treatment when the family was vehemently objecting. I'm sorry, I'm not sure how to make.
So the two things I think have changed in the law in the last few years on that is that traditionally you need to show but-for causation, meaning you need to show that would it have made a difference? The problem with these situations in ICU care is even had you provided the treatment, the patient probably was going to die anyway, right? So you can't show causation that had you provided the requested treatment, it would have made any difference. Most states have now flipped to drop the requirement for but-for causation, and now you can proceed on what's called lost chance causation. So in other words, there's a 99% chance that CPR was not going to work for an elderly hospital inpatient. Never be able to show but-for causation. It probably wasn't going to work anyway, even if we had done it. Now, in most states, you can proceed to say, well, I can't prove that would have made any difference, but I can prove that you've deprived us of that opportunity. You've deprived us of that 1% chance that CPR might have worked. And that's a compensable injury now in most states. And I think that's why those sorts of futility cases can now proceed in a tort damages type action in a way that they couldn't have in many states just a few years ago.
Good. I have the impression, and I'd like your take on it, that no physician has been successfully sued for following a do not resuscitate order. But physicians have successfully been sued for not following it, leaving the family with perhaps a totally dependent patient for somebody who has to leave their job and take care of them. Am I right?
I'm happy to actually have both that and I answer that, because I am aware of cases in which there were settlements for resuscitating when there was a DNR order that was explicit. And there is a case pending, and I have to say that I think it's still pending in California with respect to Pulse, where there was an order not to provide treatment with support by a guardian who was at the bedside, and the physician resuscitated anyway, and that's being still litigated to my knowledge. So I think that there are two cases on that front. I think Thad has talked about the intentional infliction of distress for people who have been not resuscitated when families wanted them to be, but I don't know of cases in which the physician or others have been successfully sued for not resuscitating someone who was a DNR order, sorry, who did not have a DNR order, when in their clinical judgment, resuscitation would not have been successful. So, Thad, you probably know.
I agree. I mean, I think there's generally a good faith. As long as it looks, the pulse or the DNR looks valid, even if it wasn't, as long as you had a good faith belief and then didn't resuscitate on the basis of that, there's immunity. So I think I would generally agree with what you said. I guess, and I think maybe we'll just take Ron's question. I think it is
time.
Yeah, it's time.
Is Jahi McMath such a rare exception that the standard criteria for brain death remain, or does it challenge the standard criteria?
If they can prove she's alive, then I think there's a serious problem. I mean, there's already, Bob, all these people are already questioning the philosophical, conceptual soundness of it. But to have a case like that, right, if you actually get a court of law to say she's alive now, unprecedented in history, worldwide, it's going to be a significant prompt for reexamination, sure. It's potentially one of the most exciting bioethics cases ever.
On that note, thank you very much.
The most exciting.
Mark your calendar now for the 18th annual meeting of the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities, coming up October 6th through 9th of 2016 in Washington, D.C. This is a production of Roland Recording.